Madam Chair, I've got Senate File 665, which is a pretty short and straightforward bill. It extends Medicaid eligibility to youth aging out of the foster care system automatically from up to age 21. There's about 600 youth who leave foster homes at age 18 or a little older when they choose to, and they often have ongoing mental health or health needs, which they often need to have continued treatment for. And the vast majority of these youth really are still eligible for Medicaid, but because of troubles with paperwork and they're a fairly mobile group, they often don't fill out all the paperwork and get all of the hoops jumped through to maintain their eligibility, and these services really are needed for these youth. So again, there's about 600 per year, up to 600 per year, and this would really help them make that difficult transition from youth to adulthood in a more fruitful manner. So with some more rationale, I have Mary Reagan here, who can help talk about it, or we can answer questions.
Welcome, Ms. Reagan.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you. My name is Mary Reagan. I'm with the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, which is a statewide association of providers of treatment services for children and adolescents. And about 2 years ago, our members started coming to me with concerns about what was happening to kids when they left their programs, and hearing back from the kids that they were really floundering and struggling. And we pulled together a task force, a stakeholders group, to take a look at what was happening. And this effort included input from a lot of advocacy organizations, counties, State Department of Human Services. We also did listening sessions with young people around the state. And what we came up with were several proposals. Last year we called them Ready to Launch. This year we're calling them Youth Moving Forward. But essentially they are efforts to try to provide more supports for kids when they're aging out of care so that they don't slip through the cracks, as Senator Lori indicated, so that they don't become homeless, which are real risks for these kids. And this effort to provide health insurance was identified as one of the things that would be very helpful to these kids, to be able to continue with their health care providers and not have to worry when something goes wrong with their physical or mental health that they're not covered. So we really appreciate your support. You should have a handout that indicates the number of organizations that are supporting this effort. We'll also have about 100 youth here this afternoon taking a tour of the Capitol and visiting legislators, and I hope you'll see them around.
And it looks like, according to the fiscal note, Senator Lori, the biggest challenge with this will be in the tails.
Yes, that is true. I mean,
we lose FFP, and then we also have a growing number of kids because it sort of accumulates.
Right. It's typically for 3 years for a child, so it does grow. But that, in the tails there, I think that is about where it would stabilize, what you see, that growth pattern would end about there. And again, I guess one of the key things to remember is the vast majority of these kids are eligible for Medicaid, and they're just unable to jump through the hoops that we put in their way. They're, you know, keep in mind they didn't have to leave foster care. These are youths who thought they were ready to leave and make it on their own, and oftentimes they find, well, maybe they
just like the rest of our kids, huh?
Right. Maybe they weren't quite as ready as they thought they were, and when they have that realization and they want to come back and access some of the services that they'd had whilst they were in foster care, I think it would just be a tremendous benefit for them to be able to get to those services right away rather than to get to the barriers and the application process, which is daunting and whatnot. So again, the vast majority of these are eligible, and it's really the barriers. So that's, and I do know also, Madam Chair, that that you have a similar measure in your Coverall Kids bill that would, instead of Medicaid, have them covered, have these youths covered by Minnesota Care, for which we might have a better chance of getting health care access funds rather than general funds for the state share of the
yes.
Medicaid expenditure. And that is something that we'd also support and look at as an alternative.
Senator Laurie, I do believe that these children should be treated more like our own kids, and we should try and do the things we would do for our own kids when they're leaving home. So I guess we'll just lay this aside and keep working on money and see what happens.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Welcome. So I saw Senator Lynch somewhere. I might just announce to everyone that we only will be meeting today until 10 o'clock. So that's one of the reasons I'm trying to get going here. Senator Lynch, they're waiting for you, dear.
Madam Chair, thank you. Good morning. I'm here with Senate File 503, and I'm happy to be here.
What's that?
We're happy to have you.
Madam Chair, we had some good discussion about this in the policy committee. We're bringing this forward at this time because we are interested in looking at reform ideas and cost containment strategies. And I think this fits that bill, and on top of that seeks to address an issue that we have discussed often in this division with regard to the need for mental health services across the state. And with me this morning, I have a couple of people that will talk a little bit more about the need, and I think we'll begin this morning with Mr. Ruse.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senators, my name is Nicholas Ruse, and I am a licensed professional counselor in Minnesota. I'm also a licensed professional psychologist in Minnesota, and then if I tell you that, I have to tell you I'm licensed at the doctoral level. I'm a professor at counselor education at Winona State University. I'm the chair of the board of Minnesota Behavioral Health and Therapy that licenses professional counselors and professional clinical counselors and professional alcohol and drug counselors. On Wednesday afternoons for longer than I can remember, I'm a volunteer counselor at Walk-In Counseling in Minneapolis. It's on Chicago, just off Franklin. It's a free mental health clinic for the people of the greater metro area, although most tend to come from Minneapolis. Senate File 503 is the last piece of the work that was started by the DHS Task Force on Mental Health in Minnesota. I was a member of that representing the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy, and the licensed professional clinical counselor was created in 2006, I believe, 2007, but due to timing issues, we weren't able to get on the budget back then. So the license was passed, but not the second part of the bill, which was to get us included in the Department of Human Services as a mental health provider. So this is the last piece from, two or three years ago of working. It is of the licensed professional, mental health professionals in Minnesota. The preparation for licensed professional clinical counselors is second to none. It incorporated all of the recommendations of the task force including 4,000 post-degree hours and a 48-credit semester credit master's program. In addition to that, all of the licensed professional clinical counselors within their within 4 years after their license have to complete another 12 semester credits of graduate study in their field. So at the end of 4 years, they're somewhere between what is a normal master's level and the doctoral level in Minnesota. I teach the research methods and program evaluation at Winona State and occasionally right now at St. Mary's University in Minneapolis. I know one cannot prove a non-event, but I'd like to put some personal contact in the last few weeks into perspective. I received an email and then a follow-up call from Susan Knutson, who is a school counselor in Eden Prairie. And she's looking into maybe becoming a licensed professional clinical counselor. And the reason behind this is that she found that she was getting referrals from doctors from MDs within the school system for kids that were having problems. Well, she can't take them on long-term in the school system. Last night I talked to Javier Rodriguez-Gaitan, who is a professional counselor, just finished his master's degree at St. Mary's in Minneapolis. He works for La Familia in both Minneapolis and St. Paul. He works with truant adolescent Hispanic males. And again, you know, success on his watch wouldn't necessarily show up in a budget issue. But taking somebody off the truancy list and getting them to finish their high school degree would be major. And he's now seeking supervision for his post-degree hours. At Watkin, we've seen an increase in the number of people from all socioeconomic status ranges in the last half year. And some of them have lost their jobs, so their economic status is in a transition process. I know that you have a big task ahead of you regarding some of the funds that are available or the lack of funds that are available. But we feel that in the long run, although it's not always easy to quantify, there are sources of revenue and benefits to the state that aren't necessarily reported in the fiscal note, although we thank the Department of Human Services for coming up with their best estimation. And if there are any questions, I'd be glad to take them.
Are there any questions? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And now I'd like to yield to Christy Bordson.
Madam Chair and Senators, my name is Christy Bordson. I'm a licensed professional clinical counselor. I'm also a doctorate candidate for the Marriage and Family Therapy Program at Argosy. I come before you today to testify about my personal experience in the mental health field in Minnesota and on behalf of thousands of Minnesotans who are seeking quality mental health care in Minnesota. I feel very frustrated that my license is not recognized. This causes me professional difficulty, but more importantly, I'm not able to independently serve low-income families that are on Medicaid. The reason I stopped my master's degree was to work with the inner-city youth who are at high risk for severe emotional disturbances, often complicated by poverty. Many of my clients are put on 2 to 3 month wait lists while their mental health issues go unattended due to lack of licensed mental health professionals. All of the current LPCCs are well-educated and have over the 4,000 hours of recommended supervision that was suggested by the Mental Health Task Force in 2006. This is equal to other recognized fields in mental health professionals, but we are not able to be employed by Rule 29 agencies who serve people with Medicaid. The fiscal impact of this bill is very small and does not fully represent the face value of the cost savings to the state of Minnesota and the taxpayers. Passing this bill will also ensure less time on wait lists for clients who are in desperate need to have their mental health cares taken care of. Unfortunately, time usually makes mental health worse if it goes untreated. I work at Washburn Center for Children in Minneapolis. This is an agency that's been established for over 125 years, and we have a reputation for working with the city, providing in-home family therapy. In this program, we've had a 90% success rate in keeping children out of residential care or the hospital. I think the program's it's about 7 years old. As many of you know, residential is a really high cost to Minnesota taxpayers for people who are on Medicaid. Usually runs about $8,000 a month. So The cost savings to this is enormous. I ask you today to support the recognition of licensed professional clinical counselors. We are well-educated, well-experienced counselors who can provide a service to Minnesota that is largely needed by those on Medicaid. The service is fiscally responsible for the taxpayers due to the cost savings, and more importantly, it can improve the quality of life for Minnesotans.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, I'll just make a few comments with regard to the fiscal note that you have before you. Couple of things to note. There is a licensure fee associated with this. The license fee is $150, with the renewal being $250. I think it's pertinent to note that on the fiscal note that you can see this goes out to 2013, and it is anticipated that you can see that there's an increase each year beginning in 2010 up through 2013. It's expected that in 2013 and thereafter that number will level off. This fiscal note reflects that upon our success this session, that this these LPCCs would begin to be reimbursed in January of 2010. And just to put things in perspective, currently there are 33 LPCCs in Minnesota, and the fiscal note reflects that we anticipate an additional 20 in the coming year. I talked a little bit in my introductory comments about this being a reform piece and being a cost containment piece. I'd also suggest that this is a jobs piece. There, I have been very, frankly, impressed with the amount of communication that I have received since introducing this bill from all across Minnesota, and the stories that I've heard, in particular, people that are coming to Minnesota and or maybe perhaps choosing not to come to Minnesota, because upon further inquiry, they gain understanding that while they are able to practice without having this reimbursement, it is a significant deterrent, not only to the job seekers and the job holders, but also to the Minnesotans out there that need mental health services.
So, Senator Lynch, I find it always to be very interesting that people want to be reimbursed, and then when they get reimbursed, then they complain about how much they get reimbursed.
Madam Chair,
Senator Lynch.
Humor at this point in the game is always good.
Any questions for the witnesses or for Senator Lynch? All right, we'll have to set this aside and see what we're doing when we find our any money.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Well, I guess we'll do my bill next. Oh, Senator Erickson Ropes, do you want to do your bill?
Yes, I do. Chair and committee members. I am here today to present a bill on modifying the Medical Assistance Drug Formulary Committee provisions. And this bill was brought to me by NAMI and the mental health communities. It addresses access to medications. Right now, the state has a drug formulary committee that decides which medications require prior authorization. And we believe that is causing a disconnect for a lot of folks that have mental health diagnoses and being able to get their medications. And so we have done a couple things. One is increase the transparency of the Drug Formulary Committee in terms of their posting information on openings on the committee and minutes. And in addition, it would add two more consumer representatives onto the committee, along with a clinical researcher. And then secondly, the bill would not require prior authorization for medications to treat mental illness if there's not a generic available or if there's a new method of delivery of a drug. And I'll stop there and take questions and allow my testifiers to speak if they wish.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota. I know many of you heard me testify in the policy committee about the need for this bill. You know, I think all of us know that it can be very difficult to find the right medication and the right dosage and the right delivery method. It can take years to find the right combination. We think that actually new delivery methods can be very helpful for people in terms of treatment adherence. You know, for you women out there, you know that some of you prefer a daily dose of calcium. Other people like to take it once a month. I ended up never taking it when I had it once a month. You know, so we all kind of respond differently to different approaches. Because you've heard me talk before, I'd like to just focus actually on the fiscal note that was presented. You know, I knew the department wanted to kill the bill, but I didn't know they wanted to kill it this bad. First of all, I would actually, I was wondering why they actually have a half-time pharmacist for the committee. Now, the committee is already, as you know, functioning. There is already a pharmacist who provides advice to them. What we're doing is expanding the transparency, and I have a hard time believing that you need a half-time additional pharmacist to post the notices to the website, to include another person, to have a very public way of appointing people to the committee. Secondly, we would love to know how many prior authorizations are already now reviewed and approved. The offset of cost of not having to do that is not included here. If, you know, when I talked to one of the private health insurance companies, challenging them on their prior authorization, they approved like 90% of them. So, you know, that's kind of a ridiculous cost if you think about it, an administrative cost. So I don't know why the department has not reduced their costs for having to not do prior authorizations for medications to treat mental illness. One of the factors in the fiscal note says that this is due to new and expensive drugs that may not be therapeutic. First of all, when you look at the FDA website, you can actually see how many new drugs are in the pipeline, and there's not a lot. Someone just testified to that yesterday over in the House, and that most of the experimental stuff that's going on now is looking at the efficacy between different medications. I will point out that we are, of course, allowing generics to be used. If those come forward, you know, then yes, you use generics. We've always had antipsychotics, not required for prior authorization, so the sentence seems to imply that they're adding that in as well. And then I guess we have to question the premise that psychiatrists and doctors are really going to prescribe medications that aren't at all therapeutic. I think that that's, you know, not really a good statement to make. They also don't factor in perhaps the reduced cost for all the doctors, nurses, pharmacists in hospitals and clinics around the state who now won't have to go through all that paperwork, make all those phone calls, you know, to the department, making sure that those authorizations are done. And lastly, we clearly don't factor in the cost of what happens now when people aren't adhering to their treatment plan. So I was surprised by the fiscal note. You know, and I recognize in this time of, you know, great economic crisis that, you know, you don't have $6 million and $10 million in the future to throw up to this. But I just wanted to point my testimony to the fiscal note. And we actually have a psychiatrist here today as well.
Hi. I'm Dr. Julie Peterson. I'm representing the Minnesota Psychiatric Society. And she's already made some of the points that I was really thinking about when I heard about this. I really wanted to talk about, like, the medication compliance issue because it's very concerning to me when someone goes to the pharmacy and they have to wait for medications because there's always the risk they won't come back. If someone has to have a prior authorization done, it can take a few days to really get it done because of shuttling back and forth between the insurer, getting the correct paperwork accomplished. And the real concern is that someone won't fill their medications, they'll go off medications, and then can be really at a high risk for rehospitalization, which, as we all know, is very expensive. So really, I think we have to think about someone, you know, and their whole care in terms of keeping them out of the hospital. Because if you're really looking at, you know, a best clinical care for someone, sometimes it does include, you know, very specific medications, as a lot of the people that I see have already been on a wide variety of medications, and really trying to get them the best medication that helps them stay stable and stay out of the hospital is really the best clinical care and is really the most cost-effective care. So I really wanted to talk about that compliance issue and the risk that the prior authorization really brings to the compliance, taking medications appropriately and as directed. So that kind of issue is really significant. I think the other issue is sort of looking at the clinical time that doing prior authorizations takes away from basically patient time. I mean, I do my own prior authorizations, and, you know, we talk a lot about getting adequate access to psychiatry, that there's not enough psychiatrists, that there's not enough providers. And when I'm doing paperwork, I'm obviously not having time to see patients. So, and, you know, I know every office does it different. Some offices have nurses do it, but it's, you know, in my office, it's me. So, you know, it'd really be great if that wasn't there, if I could just spend my time seeing patients, which is what I like to do and what I really feel fills a public health need. So I'm kind of looking at the clinical piece, too.
And do you just want to state your name for the record?
Oh, Dr. Julie Peterson.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Erickson Ropes. In looking at your fiscal note, I too was surprised, frankly. And the fiscal note indicates that a large part of this is due to the addition of a 0.5 FTE.
And that's not a large part of it.
No. Is that a critical component of this, or is that something that you might want to take a look at?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, this has been my first experience since I've been at the Senate with a really shocking fiscal note. Like most of the other fiscal notes I've gotten with my projects have seemed rather reasonable. This one is just, frankly, silly. The inclusion of the halftime pharmacist, although a small addition, is just, it seems like it's been pulled out of the air, frankly. And as Ms. Aberholden explained earlier, it's not needed to enhance the function of the committee. I find it shocking also that the fiscal note seems to suggest that the department now is going to be second-guessing the doctor's prescriptive choices by saying, they just say directly here, you know, there may be drugs that are prescribed that have little or no therapeutic advantage. It's like, I think the doctor and the patient need to make those kinds of decisions. And the department, you know, perhaps would be seeing if there's a generic alternative. I can understand that, but saying that a doctor doesn't know what to prescribe to their patients is ridiculous. And then projecting that this could escalate into hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, I think that's a little over the top. I do think there could be some potential increase as far as the fiscal note is, in that as you take down a barrier between a patient and a medication, the patients are going to get to their medications, and then there's going to be an expense. Right now what we're finding is patients get the prescription, go stand in line at Target, wait to get their prescription, and then get up to the front of the line, and the pharmacist says, I'm sorry, you need prior authorization. And then the patient either has to go back to work or has transportation issues or gets frustrated or whatever the problem is. I mean, it would be difficult for us to have to go through the same thing and then have to take another day off of work. And, I mean, you just say, forget it. I'm not going to get my prescription filled. So if we're taking away that barrier, there are going to be more people get their medications. And that's what we were hoping that the department would focus on, is how many people that don't get their medications because of the prior authorization roadblock may be able to get them now, and I don't see that here.
So, Senator Erickson Ropes, why don't we see if there's anyone from the department that would like to comment about the fiscal note?
Crazy, since they
or answer questions about it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Drake. I'm the pharmacy program manager at DHS. Regarding the 0.5 pharmacist position, that was added to the fiscal note when there was in the bill the recommendation to add additional consumer representatives to the committee. We really wanted the consumer representatives to be able to fully participate in the committee, and it's a technical and clinical advisory committee that covers all different courses of drugs. And we really thought, and the information that's used by the committee is very technical and clinical in nature, and we thought it, as it is, it would be difficult for the consumer representatives to understand it. And so we thought it would be useful to have an extra pharmacist on to be able to present the information, research it, and present it to the consumer representatives in a consumer-friendly way.
And the rest of the fiscal note?
The rest of the fiscal note is with the requirements on prior authorization. And to come up with the numbers, we used a market share approach based on some studies that are out there in terms of how much market share shifts to a non-preferred agent when it's removed from prior authorization. And so we used that approach to determine the difference in cost between the preferred agents and the non-preferred agents. And then there was also a piece that we took in the piece about atypical antipsychotics. What this bill does is it prohibits prior authorization for any atypical antipsychotic, even if a generic is available. So we had to make the assumption that there would be some shift from generic to brand because there would be no restrictions on it.
Thank you. Are there questions? Okay, thank you very much. Well, we will set this aside. And I guess we'll move on to my bill next.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senate File 1150, Minnesota Family Investment Program Appropriation, Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This bill deals with the support work appropriation in the MFIP program. And just to refresh your memory, that is a program where people in MFIP work for nonprofit organizations and other groups, and when they can't find a job within the 6 weeks that the federal government allows them to find a job, then they can ask the county if there are supported work positions available. And the supported work positions are then allowed for a number of months, and through the skills that they gain and the work history that they gain, then the theory is that they then can go on and find a paid job. And this has worked pretty well. Currently, however, we know that the economy, bleak as it is, means that even more people in the MFIP program need to rely on supported work, and that the supported work maybe needs to be over a longer period of time because there aren't jobs to transition into from the supported work positions. And so that was the theory behind this bill, was to put more money into supported work this first year of the biennium, and the second year of the biennium in the budget we have no dollars for supported work, and so that's why the larger amount is there for the second year. And And part of the thought behind this also on my part was that we will be receiving stimulus monies for MFIP that are available for funding supported work. So Congress realized that we would be having this problem where more people would need supported work. So that was my thinking. I have a witness here we can hear from, Deborah Schlick, and then I'll be ready for questions.
Okay. Ms. Schlick, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. I'm Deborah Schlick. I'm with the Affirmative Options Coalition. We're a coalition of 50 nonprofit organizations around the state of Minnesota. We strongly support passage of this bill, and I'll reiterate a couple of points that Senator Berglund made, but before that, I'd like to remind the committee that the most common reason a parent applies for cash assistance in Minnesota is that they've just lost a job. That the MFIP program serves as the unemployment safety net for low-wage working parents. And if you recall, a few weeks ago, you heard from a parent who lives in Anoka County who had lost a job at Target because she couldn't come up with the evening child care that was requested for a shift change. Had that request been made of her further down in a few more months of her employment history, she would have qualified for unemployment insurance. But because she had been there such a short period of time, she has to turn to the MFIP program. She didn't testify, but what has put her in better employment stead is the supported work program that Anoka County runs. So she was able to get skills, training, and experience that put her in a more stable job that are less likely to disrupt her employment. Because this program is serving as the unemployment safety net for so many low-wage working parents who lose work, the budget forecast released last week anticipates a 6% increase in the MFIP caseload because of what it calls job destruction in our economy. And as Senator Berglund referenced, the federal government has made emergency TANF funds available. Minnesota is likely to earn a number of those funds in part probably because of what it has done around supported work to date. But the federal government has not relaxed its expectations that the state, as it sees increasing numbers of people come on welfare-to-work programs, meet its work outcomes. Supported work is an important tool to doing that. So we'd urge your support.
Thank you. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I guess the next thing I'd like to do is just ask a few questions about the fiscal note. Because if you look at the fiscal note, you'll see the line that says TANF Emergency Fund Revenue Impact. And it's a fairly small impact compared to what we have been led to believe might be available for this purpose through the emergency fund. And so I guess I'm wondering why we don't have a larger number on this fiscal note sheet.
I'd like to invite the department to come forward at this time. Welcome.
Jenny Ernst, Department of Human Services. Madam Chair, members. The TANF Emergency Fund revenues are just an estimate at this point. We don't have direction yet from Health and Human Services as to exactly how they'll be calculated. This is our best estimate right now. They are based on the increase in the assistance payments to MFIP and DWP participants. So the numbers you see on this fiscal note reflect the 80% that we expect of the MFIP and DWP grants only.
Well, Senator Chair, Berglund. I guess I would just like to know if the department has any idea when they'll have a more firm number that we could work with.
We are listening in on conference calls to find out more information about this, but we haven't been given any direction yet about when we can anticipate additional direction from Health and Human Services. We're hoping it's soon.
Are there questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, I would just ask that we get that information as soon as it becomes available. Members of the committee may not remember this, but by federal law, the legislature has to appropriate TANF funds. So we can't just say, you know, spend whatever you get, kind of. We have to actually put an appropriation in a bill for them to be able to use it for this purpose. And so I am getting anxious that we aren't going to be getting the information we need to do that.
Senator Berglund, I don't think you're... I know many of us share the, that same anxiousness. And as has been pointed out, that 6% increase in the MFIP caseload is no small number. And it's imperative that we make a very conscious effort to utilize the federal dollars that are coming down with that stimulus package to help Minnesota families.
Madam Chair.
Senator Putner Sola.
Before the person from the department leaves, it's my understanding that the funds will be certified on the 17th. Is that and I believe that administration expects to have their numbers by that time. I'm wondering if that could be verified.
We'll invite the department to come back.
Madam Chair, members, the question of when we'll find out what TANF funds we have available exactly, we don't know yet. We don't have that information.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Prentner Solon.
And I think Senator Berglund made this request, but could we get a copy of that as soon as you receive that?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? Okay, then following the chair's lead, I believe we'll lay this aside. And there being no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned.